And welcome to Bingham Presents 2012 Criminal Enforcement of Securities Laws, broadcast live from Bingham McCutcheon LLP in New York and online on www.sechistorical.org. My name is Lisa Fairfax, and I am the Leroy Sorensen Merrifield Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School, and I'm going to be the moderator for today's program. This program is the fourth in the Bingham Presents series, and it's made possible through a partnership between Bingham McCutcheon LLP and the SEC Historical Society. With more than 1,000 lawyers in offices on three continents, anchored by major commitments in the world's key financial centers, Bingham McCutcheon LLP offers market-leading practices focused on the financial services industry. The SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum celebrates its 10th anniversary in 2012 and has welcomed more than 1 million visitors. The Bingham Presents series debuted in 2009 to provide insight into current issues in financial regulation of interest to the legal profession. The dedicated Bingham Presents section under programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive shares the previous programs in the series. Those programs are New World of Financial Regulation, which was presented in 2009, Harmonization of the Regulation of Investment Advisors and Broker-Dealers in 2010, and last year's Enforcement After Dodd-Frank. The SEC Historical Society is grateful for the continuing generous sponsorship of Bingham McCutcheon LLP for the series. Tonight, we're going to be looking at criminal enforcement of securities laws. Joining me today to discuss this very important issue are Mark Miner. He's the Bureau Chief at Investor Protection in the Office of the Attorney General for the State of New York. George Canellos of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, currently Deputy Director in the Division of Enforcement and former Director of the New York Regional Office. And Susan Merrill of Bingham McCutcheon LLP and former Director of Enforcement for FINRA. Before we begin, I'd just like to state that the views shared today are those of the individual presenters and are not representative of Bingham McCutcheon, the SEC Historical Society, the New York Office of Attorney General, or the SEC. The SEC Historical Society selected me as the moderator, and I have worked with the presenters today to develop an area of discussion. So let's just begin. I want to start first with a general topic that's aimed at kind of giving us some background and context for our discussion. So I'll start first with Susan to just give us an idea about how did we get here? How has the criminal enforcement of securities laws evolved, particularly since the financial crisis?
Well, as we sit here today, about 4 years after the Lehman bankruptcy, where the stock market fell from 14,000 down to a low of 6,400 in just over a year, that really was the kickoff to the financial crisis, fueled primarily by the mortgage bubble and subprime lending. And the financial crisis has brought reams of regulation. Regulatory regulation has blanketed Wall Street since that time. The rules and laws behind Dodd-Frank have not even fully been written or implemented yet. But still, there's a public perception that you read in the newspapers so often and even hear from some in the halls of Congress that the people responsible for the financial crisis have not been brought to justice. And the Department of Justice has brought over 600 mortgage fraud-related cases since the beginning of the crisis. They have a financial fraud enforcement task force that has been prosecuting those cases all across the United States. Few have been high-profile targets, though. And I think there's a reason for that. This financial crisis didn't easily lend itself to criminal prosecution. It was primarily brought on by a failure in judgment and risk management from those who were in the top seats at some of the banks that failed miserably because of the subprime crisis. And the legislation that's come out of it has attempted to address those risks and see to it that risk management is bolstered and that there are safeguards in place. But that doesn't make for a good criminal case. The two hedge fund managers from Bear Stearns who were prosecuted very shortly after the financial crisis began in connection with the collapse of two large hedge funds that were heavily leveraged in subprime was a colossal failure for DOJ. They were acquitted. And even the SEC has seen some setbacks trying to get verdicts against individuals in some of these subprime-related vehicles. So it hasn't been an easy road for criminal prosecutors to hoe, but primarily I think because of the fact that these failures were not of the fraudulent intent type, which does lead itself to criminal prosecution.
George, let me just get your perspective on kind of how we've gotten to where we are today with regard to the criminal enforcement. You know, and certainly that kind of goes in tandem with what the SEC has been doing on the civil side.
Well, I think Susan's right. In general, I think these are very rough areas of comparability, but I think you can think of various periods in time where we've had big financial crises. There's the financial crisis that was generally began in 2007, 2008. Many of the people in the room remember well the tech bubble bursting in the year 2000 as well. And I think a lot of people associate the years 2002 and 2003 and 2004 with a really accounting or corporate fraud crisis brought on initially by the revelation of the Enron fraud, then the WorldCom fraud, then the Adelphia fraud, followed by the revelations of many other types of improprieties in accounting. The middle crisis is fundamentally different from the other two, in my view. I mean, the middle crisis was inherently a law enforcement crisis when Enron went from having a market capitalization of many tens of billions of dollars to zero overnight, and WorldCom essentially the same. It was because there was obviously a false depiction of both of those companies' financial conditions, and someone had committed a very serious fraud, and it really was only a question of finding out who is directly responsible in the sense of being highly culpable and acting intentionally, who was reckless, who was potentially negligent, whether auditors ought to catch the problem. But it was, by its very nature, a law enforcement crisis. The bursting of the tech bubble, the first of the ones that I just mentioned, in my view, was the kind of business, a kind of a major business problem that left many people unhappy and many people crying, having a human desire for accountability, but wasn't by its very nature crying out as a law enforcement crisis. Like so many instances in which the exuberance of the market leads to pessimism, a bubble bursts, and there is a great depression in stock price and or the economy, many fraudulent practices that were going on undetected in times of exuberance, or that for practical purposes were very hard to enforce, suddenly became evident or easier to enforce. I mean, someone who's making 30% in the S&P and perhaps fraudulently losing a percentage or two is still making 28%. It's a little harder as a practical matter to bring such cases to the jury, less so when there's been a huge drop. So enforceability improves, and very importantly, when bubbles break, you reveal frauds. But it doesn't mean that the breaking of the bubble is itself a fraud. And I think that the financial crisis is more analogous to the breaking of the tech bubble. There have been frauds exposed. I think there's easier enforceability of some conduct that we would always have viewed as fraudulent, but that hadn't necessarily resulted in the kinds of acute losses that they did during the financial crisis. And so, but I don't think it follows from observing this crisis that you say there's a crisis, you know, let's go find the people who caused it and bring them to justice, because it's not by its nature necessarily criminal or even a securities violation.
One of the difficulties with these types of frauds is, you know, there might not be create kind of person behind it, who's the subject of kind of criminal enforcement, criminal investigation. Notwithstanding that, there has been, right, some additional activity. Mark, can you talk a little bit for us about kind of what that additional activity has been looking like, particularly in kind of more recent years?
Sure. you know, the fact that it's difficult to ascertain a specific individual who's responsible doesn't really stop the human cry for the, you know, the head on a stick. But I think that the recent statistics that have been maintained by the FBI would bear out that they're in their most recent report, which was 010 through 11, that there are there's a general trending both in the incidence of reporting of fraud and the number of investigations that are undertaken by various agencies. So these are national statistics, and some of these may vary from region to region. But in each of the past 5 years, the number of frauds being reported has gone up. And over the past 2 years, comparing that with the prior two-year reporting cycle, the number of fraud investigations are up 52%. Now, anybody who has been working in this area for a while will know that after certain major news events, Madoff, what have you, there are significant spikes in the reporting of activity. Anybody who can't get in touch with their broker, you know, for a couple days, you know, at some period of time, was reporting that. And so there was some over-reporting. I think that also there was a shift in budget and allocation of resources at various federal and state agencies in an attempt to be responsive to the financial crisis, as it were. And so that may also explain some of that spike. But clearly the trend over the past 5 years was an increasing reporting, and a 52% jump, I think everybody has to agree, is a significant shift in it and requires a lot of attention from any law enforcement agency. Specifically, amongst the types of frauds, for securities fraud, in the top five were included Ponzi schemes. Obviously, the reporting of Ponzi schemes, as I mentioned, everybody saw a Ponzi scheme. Affinity. Affinity frauds has been a growing problem. States have certainly reported a growth in this area as the pool of potential victims has gotten smaller and smaller. But people are looking for some return on an investment. I think they're increasingly attracted by some person or group with whom they have some relationship, and this makes them, unfortunately, more attractive victims for those whom they might feel a greater sense of comfort to. Pyramid schemes are still in the top five. Prime bank investment schemes, also referred to as special access schemes, where they'll say in this horrible down economy, we have access to a Fed window rate or this reduced rate for this period of time. For whatever reason, that was very attractive over the past couple of years. And then advanced fee schemes and promissory notes. Specifically on the state side, what we can tell you, in the North American Securities Administrators Association, we track this information and our statistics in an aggregate as well. And so we see all of the same schemes that you would see covered anywhere else. I'd also add just market manipulation and pump and dump to that. We see a lot of that on the state side. And we also track, in terms of criminal enforcement specifically, states' contribution to any criminal enforcement. And that is up 25%. We measure that in the number of years of incarceration in the aggregate that states contribute to. And that is up 25%. It also may reflect a more vigorous enforcement by local prosecutors or federal prosecutors who are either bringing those cases or unable to bring those matters to some other conclusion. And so the sentences relating to that may be longer. And finally, referrals by states to law enforcement agencies is up over last year by nearly 30%. And so, you know, with those, I think that we can clearly see that there has been hyper focus and interest in the market. The constituencies that we serve on the state level are asking for greater attention to these areas, and it's certainly reflected in the data that we see.
You know, whenever there's a kind of uptick in the criminal enforcement of securities laws, it raises the kind of question about, you know, how best to marry the enforcement of securities laws on the criminal side with the enforcement of securities laws on the civil side. So can you guys talk a bit about kind of where does that end? Where should that end? How do those two pieces work together? Maybe Susan could take a stab first.
Sure. Congress set it up this way, that there would be overlapping jurisdiction on the securities laws being prosecuted civilly by the SEC, and any willful violation of the 33 or 34 Act can be prosecuted criminally by the Department of Justice. Add to that the overlapping jurisdiction with state regulators and with the SROs, and you have a bit of a five-ring circus. But I do think that there's utility to having the overlapping jurisdiction, that the idea is that nothing falls through the cracks, and that there are certain types of conduct that are uniquely suitable for criminal prosecution. For example, when hundreds of millions of dollars go missing and customers of particular firms can't find that money in their accounts, that is certainly something that is appropriately within the criminal jurisdiction to at least investigate. The problem is that I don't think that Congress envisioned the massive duplication that you have now with virtually every high-profile securities case being looked at and investigated by both the SEC and the Department of Justice. And it's not really a question of where does one end and the other begin, because quite often they're going on in tandem, which raises quite a lot of issues for people who are under investigation. So I think there are certainly cases where it's appropriate for the criminal authorities to be involved at an early stage, indeed crucial, and where criminal prosecution is really the only appropriate outcome, which involves punishment and loss of liberty. But there are certainly a lot of securities cases that I've seen recently where having the DOJ jump in has complicated things needlessly in an area in which I don't think there's a realistic outcome that's going to be criminal.
George, do you have some thought more about that, and especially this question about kind of the appropriateness of when, you know, criminal enforcement over civil enforcement?
Yeah. And so on the subject of the question of, you know, what is a criminal case, I used to wear a different hat for 9 years. I was a federal criminal prosecutor, most of that time doing securities fraud. So I was working with the SEC. Now I'm at the SEC working with my former colleagues. So, you know, the interesting question is sort of what's a criminal case?
You have a different answer now.
No. I mean, I think that you know, this is maybe too much of a generalization, but a criminal securities case is a civil securities case with a little better proof and a little more jury appeal. I mean, that's it. Because frankly, if you look at, I mean, you look at the elements of securities fraud, and I'm talking about 10B or 15C or 17A1, scienter-based securities fraud. Not our negligence-based claims, not our failure to supervise claims. But if you look at the statutory elements of a Section 10B civil claim, they include materiality, false or deception, a degree of mens rea. And mens rea is scienter, and scienter, while we talk about scienter being capable of being demonstrated through recklessness, I think it's fair to say that the prevailing appellate definition of scienter is something very much akin to knowing misrepresentation. It either has to be deliberate, intentional misrepresentation, or it needs to be the circumstances need to be such that it should have been obvious that it was a misrepresentation. The only extra element that makes something criminal is willfulness, and the standard for willfulness was established in the 1960s by the Second Circuit and remains the current one. And it is simply having the added element of having some apprehension, having an apprehension of the wrongfulness of your conduct. And the courts make clear that when you don't have to know it's illegal, just wrongful. So any fraud counts. Deceiving someone to take their money, deceiving someone to sell securities, clearly, by its nature, involves knowing you're doing something wrongful. So basically the elements line up, and the differences, therefore, become procedural ones. One requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt, also requires unanimity of 12 ordinary jurors, and the other doesn't always require unanimity, though it often does. Sometimes you can get to a judge, and the standard is preponderance of the evidence. The other, frankly, important factor is civil cases, and again, I'm overstating it for a little bit of effect, are more or less infinitely settleable. Mm-hmm. Not all, but essentially there are a lot of scope for settlement of civil cases, whereas criminal cases tend to be all or nothing. And I think that explains a lot of the difference between what is civil and what is criminal. And, I mean, there's a little bit of a gut sense on the prosecutor's part that this is really bad conduct that I ought to be punishing, that it's, you know, fair to put someone in prison for, which, you know, elevates the standard a little bit. But it's really the element of jury appeal and the gravity of the kind of take the money and run quality that I think tends to elevate a civil case to a criminal case. I don't think it's necessarily always helpful that we have, in effect, separate agencies or departments at the federal level with civil authority and criminal authority. Mark's office, and he could comment on how it works in practice, has both civil and criminal authority. And I do sometimes think that there is a great deal of redundancy in the work, in the effort that's put in by criminal and civil investigators, notwithstanding what I think is seamless, excellent coordination between the SEC and the Justice Department. I think it's outstanding, as good as you could possibly hope for, but still, we're doing different things. We have different objectives. We can't go over the ethical wall that separates grand jury from civil cases. So there's necessarily some degree of redundancy. So there's some inefficiency. And also there's a little bit of a question of calibration. If you're a criminal prosecutor and all you have is nothing or a criminal charge, it's possible that in coming up with a calibrated approach, if you are ultimately responsible for both criminal and civil, some cases might be resolved civilly when instead they're resolved through, let's say, deferred prosecution agreements or non-prosecution agreements, which are sort of quasi-civil remedies. So I'm not sure that Congress has done us a complete favor by separating civil and criminal enforcement. Mark?
Is there a better road?
Well, I think that there certainly are efficiencies that can be had. As most of you know, violations of the Martin Act can result in either civil or criminal action. And so in that regard, the same individuals who are digging in and investigating the extent of the conduct are the same people who will then be weighing in on whether or not the conduct itself arises to something serious enough, or the amount in controversy is significant enough, or the number of victims extensive enough that it may merit criminal consideration. You know, I think that it's interesting that we're talking about when a matter that has been investigated and could be civil ends up being a criminal, and where you draw that line, because it's been my experience that very often what we see could clearly be charged as criminal, and we're often making a decision about whether or not we're going to expend the resources or use the resources that we have, you know, as precious as they are, to pursue the criminal case. All of us have limited resources and try to find ways that we are going to spend those and use them intelligently. And I'd say just as often, we're confident that what we are seeing does meet all those tests and standards of some criminal behavior. And sometimes for the sake of the resources of your office, you're making some determination that it's easier. Sometimes you can achieve your level of investor protection by ensuring that someone is out of the industry and that's done in a public way. And if you can get restitution for the victims, sometimes that is a consideration that is a part of the mix as well. And so I can tell you that from our office's standpoint, we find it greatly beneficial to be able to have the same people who have educated themselves very often on some complex schemes or matters and get to know the players or the people or the firms or the conduct involved to be the same individuals who are then weighing in. There is obviously a delay if you have to get a whole new team up to speed. And I think there is also a greater continuity of your policy objective of the institution because it's the same institution. And so if there are a series of frauds or activities that you are seeing from your trending that need greater attention, you can give those priorities. Sometimes I certainly can't speak for federal agencies, but I know they all have the same overall mission of trying to protect the public, but sometimes those may need to be squared where there is obviously an advantage that we might have from the opportunity to have the same people who have decided on that mission and directive up front to be the same people who are making the decision. And so it's helpful. And we can also be brutally honest with ourselves about the level or extent of evidence that we do have and whether or not this is the appropriate case to deploy resources or, you know, keep your powder dry.
Thank you. I mean, it sounds like the dividing line, both in terms of appropriateness and other considerations, is both a legal and a practical line that you guys are talking about. One of the things I think you guys all touched on was the fact that, you know, sometimes when you have these parallel enforcement actions going on, they raise particular challenges. I think they raise particular challenges for the enforcer as well as for particular challenges, I think, for those who are representing people who are targets or people or corporations or entities, targets of both two actions going on at the same time. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that. I'll start with Susan about kind of those particular types of challenges.
Well, the Department of Justice's appearance in the investigation undeniably complicates representation issues. Even more complicated sometimes, though, is when you don't know whether the Justice Department is involved or not involved. And I think in today's current climate, you have to assume that if you have a high-profile securities investigation going on, that the Department of Justice, if they haven't surfaced, may very well be in the background. But assuming they have surfaced, there are some trade-offs that I think, especially if you're representing an individual witness, you have to analyze carefully. For example, if the Department of Justice has decided that they're going to be the primary interviewer of witnesses and doing that in a conference room with the SEC present and maybe people from other regulators present, FBI agents taking notes, that sort of thing, it may serve your client well to go in and appear voluntarily in that setting, whereas if you were simply in a case that was being investigated by the SEC, you may take a more defensive approach and wait for formal testimony. But there can be opportunities as well, because it's possible that in this investigation and by your cooperation, your client may become a benefit to the Department of Justice in other prosecutions that it's pursuing of people further up the chain, for example. And then your cooperation may have the benefit of having justice persuade the SEC that they shouldn't be bringing a civil case against your client, although possibly they could, because of the credibility issues that that will present if the Justice Department wanted to call your witness, your client as a witness in the prosecution of another target. So it certainly does present challenges. I think it presents challenges not only for the bar, but also for the SEC and justice, and George can talk about that more directly, but there have been quite a number of cases lately where the SEC's involvement in a matter has tripped up in one way or the other the federal prosecution. We just saw the reversal of the Squawk Box cases because of Brady material that was in the hands of the SEC that was not turned over.
In the hands of the Justice Department.
It was in the hands of the SEC.
Provided to the Justice Department.
Then provided to the Justice Department. And, in fact, the SEC person who was involved in the case had pointed out to Justice, I think, that you should look at these transcripts for Brady, and then they were not turned over by Justice. And so that was the basis for a reversal.
So provided and pointed out by the SEC.
Provided and pointed out. but it does complicate things because there are issues about whether justice is obligated to be reviewing attorney work product of the SEC when it's doing its Brady review. So it presents challenges on both sides, and those are things that complicate, but also can be an opportunity for your client.
Sure, you want to just elaborate a little bit more about some of the challenges from the SEC side when there's an ongoing or parallel DOJ investigation?
Sure, provided to and pointed out. I mean, I think generally our investigations usually benefit from the involvement of the Justice Department, usually. I mean, I think that Justice Department, because it has even more potent tools than we have, has the ability to secure cooperation of witnesses and candor to a greater extent than we do, and that generally benefits both of us. I also think, you know, when you look at relationships among regulators and prosecutors, the relationship between the SEC and the criminal authorities within the Department of Justice has always been, I think, outstanding. It's very symbiotic. We do different things in the sense that we're not competing with one another in any way, shape, or form. They have exclusive jurisdiction to bring criminal cases. We can't. We have exclusive jurisdiction to bring civil cases. They can't. There are a lot of, practical complications. I mean, I think it's a good thing for an investigation when the criminal authorities are involved, but there are a lot of complications. You named some of them, Susan, but... You know, the very existence of a parallel civil case against an individual who's also criminally charged can be a complicating element for a criminal case, especially if the judges involved in the cases do not entirely stay the civil case in deference to the criminal case, because the rules of a discovery are, A, broader for civil cases, and, B, involve pretrial depositions, which just are not present in criminal cases. So that's certainly a complicating factor. Even when you get what you ask for, which is usually a stay of the civil case, that can have a lot of issues for us as well. I mean, there are a lot of cases, SEC cases, that are stayed in deference to a criminal case, and they get dusted off 5 years later for prosecution, civil prosecution, and obviously the passage of that much time with a turnover of staff, staleness of evidence, fading witness recollections is never good for someone who bears the burden of proof. So that can be a complicating element, but sometimes that's a price you're very willing to pay when you're able to bring people who have engaged in very serious misconduct to justice criminally. There's also the question of, you know, whether to file at all and redundancy of remedies, which I think, you know, we have been giving a lot of lot of thought to. If you go back to when I was first started criminally prosecuting in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, there were not a lot of monetary remedies that were available to criminal authorities. I think it was 1996 that Congress adopted and required mandatory restitution in every criminal case. And suddenly that meant that as an incident to the criminal case, a judge presiding in the criminal case could also order the defendant to pay restitution to victims. Before that time, someone could go to prison, someone could pay a fine, but not restitution, and the SEC would often be desperately needed to provide that component of restitution by means of disgorgement of ill-gotten gains and other remedies available to us. There has been generally an expansion of the authority that criminal prosecutors have to bring monetary claims, which make, in some cases, the need for us to have a parallel civil case a little less pressing than it was a couple of decades ago.
Mark, I'd like to ask you a slightly different question, which is, what are the challenges associated with having a kind of parallel state, if you will, investigation as these federal investigations are going on, sometimes both criminal and civil, or maybe the benefits of kind of stepping in from the state side?
Well, when the consideration is within our office, obviously we can make the election, and that makes it a very easy. Where we are investigating conduct along with other agencies, whether they are federal or state, it can be complicating. Sometimes it's we are perfectly willing where we know that there are other inquiries out there. Sometimes we are perfectly willing collect our information or hear from a person at the same time in another agency. Sometimes the subject of our very welcoming invitation prefer not to take us up on that. There are lots of consequences of having, I recognize, us in the room hearing the answers along with some other agency. And coordinating with other states, it really depends from state to state. Every state securities administrator does not have criminal authority. Only 5 states in the country have their securities administration authority and an attorney general's office. There's another handful who have criminal authority within that agency, and there are as many other different configurations as there are states where the Secretary of State or the Treasurer has that authority. But we have very good working relationships with them. I think we have some of the same considerations as anyone else where we know that there are other institutions with criminal authority who may also be conducting an inquiry. And one of our principal considerations is anyone looking at this? Are there 3 institutions all with similar authority looking at it, or are you looking at that activity, but from a different lens? Sometimes a consideration that we make is we're conducting an investigation to see whether or not the activity and culpability even meets a criminal threshold. For that purpose, essentially everything is civil until it's not, and you find that the activity that you're finding is reaching some threshold that makes it something more serious. And then at that point, there may be other, in New York, it's very often Eastern District, Southern District justice, or increasingly, as Susan mentioned, other federal authorities who are interested in that conduct. You have to find your way. I find that it's actually an evolving thing. Anybody who is working in this space with recent changes in law and really some more emboldened federal authority, you're seeing other actors that you probably weren't dealing with a lot very much that you were finding. And then amongst those regulators, they have a panoply of tools at their disposal. And sometimes if we're looking to make sure that the conduct of the activity is addressed, we will defer or make a decision that the best opportunity to redress the wrongful conduct is for us to move forward. And every once in a while, you know, sharp elbows notwithstanding, our office has to make an independent decision that we're going to move forward, even though there are other institutions with criminal authority who are moving forward with their own mandate.
I mean, certainly one of the things that also happens with regard to criminal enforcement efforts and civil, of course, is sometimes you have the phenomena of both individuals and then entities targeted by investigations. I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of what kind of challenges those pose, particularly from a representation point of view, but also from an enforcement point of view. So, Susan, talk a bit about that, if you can.
Well, if you truly have a corporation and individuals who've been identified as targets, it's nearly impossible, if not downright unethical, for those entities to have the same lawyer. And so right away you have an issue of representation that has to be addressed. But the problem is really when the corporation and the individuals are subjects of the investigation, and the Department of Justice does tell you and has these labels of target, subject, and witness, although the subject category seems to be quite broad and the witness category very small. So when you're told that the corporation is a subject or that a particular individual is a subject, you do have to analyze quite carefully whether joint representation is appropriate. And I think in SEC cases, and the SEC does not use those. You officially don't, but you try to signal it. But
I think we do.
Well, good, that I'm going to start asking that question on the record more often. But with the SEC, I think it's more common to see the corporation and the individuals have a joint representation, at least to a point, and particularly when it's very clear that the individual is acting with the corporation's blessing in doing what they were doing. But when you get into the criminal sphere, the stakes are higher, obviously, and it's not impossible to represent an individual and a corporation when the words subjects are being thrown around. But there are some issues that have to be taken into consideration. For example, you may think you know everything about the individual and in relationship to the conduct that's under investigation. And with the facts that you know, you may think that there's no possible conflict that could arise. But you don't know what you don't know. And the risk that something comes up unanticipated, although the risk may be very small, the magnitude of the harm that can come from that is quite real. And so in some cases, it's become common to have at least shadow counsel for an individual who you believe has absolutely no conflict whatsoever with the company, but at least it gives that person someone to talk to. I've also seen instances in which the Department of Justice has insisted that individuals be separately represented in an investigation. And in that case, you really have to go along with their suggestion. I don't think you really have much of an option there. And then you get into issues about how you're communicating and coordinating between the corporation and the individual, to say nothing of the cost involved of hiring a full legal team for each particular person who may be within the subject of the investigation. It does become a bit of a 3D chess match, but it can be handled, I think. You don't want to find yourself in a position at the end of the day where the focus is on the lawyer's decision about that joint representation. So in a close call, I think the counsel should always view as the safest road to go separate.
George, depending on who you ask, especially after legal academia, some people think it's more appropriate for the focus to be on corporations, where some people feel like it's more appropriate for the focus to be on individuals within that corporation. Do you have a kind of view on that in terms of, you know, who, what person, entity should be the target, witness, subject, or is it kind of, you know, it depends on where the evidence leads you?
Well, I guess, so I think we need to step back. There's a lot of levels at which you can analyze that issue. I think we need to begin, you need to begin by the, with the recognition that there are some statutory duties that rest with a particular person or entity and don't rest with anyone else except on some theory of secondary liability. So for, just to take an example, every public company, as probably every single person here knows, has the affirmative obligation to maintain a reasonable system of accounting controls and to maintain accurate books and records. Those obligations rest on the company, so and it's strict liability. Now, there are various provisions that could make some individual secondarily liable, but just analyzing the question of whether the company's liable is fundamentally different from analyzing the question of whether an individual is liable. So there are significant statutory differences. We also need to recognize that, you know, corporations act through individuals, and generally speaking, when you're talking about fraud, especially scienter-based fraud, you know, I think one would be hard-pressed to think you have adequate deterrence by bringing the case against the company when there is a culpable individual actor out there. Obviously, you want to reach the individual actor who's engaged in the misconduct, and I think everyone recognizes, you know, that nothing sends a message more to people than the fear of an individual liability as distinct from liability for the company that they happen to work for. So there is a, bringing cases against individuals, especially in the context of fraud, is an unbelievably important component of what we do. I don't think that people should, though, assume that you need to have an individual in every case against a company. I mentioned instances where companies have statutory obligations that are fundamentally different from the individuals who are the actors within the company. But I think there are also cases involving negligent misconduct, and we have been charging probably more frequently than we did in the past, Section 17A, 2 and 3 of the 1933 Act, the provisions of the Investment Advisors Act, anti-fraud provisions that are negligence-based. And in a negligence-based case, I do think, A, that there are some cases where you look at negligence and you ask yourself the question of, you know, how did this happen and who's at fault? And the answer is there's probably a lot more collective institutional fault than fault that belongs that should be assigned to any particular individual. The sort of it fell through the cracks because we didn't have the systems and, you know, Johnny missed it and Johnny thought Stevie was looking at it. But basically there was a fundamental flaw, a corporate flaw that you could call negligence, that is more easily assigned to the collective entity than to the individual. And second, I think that even when you have the negligent acts being perpetrated, let's say by one individual acting without association with anyone else, I think there is a practical difference in the way we do and that we can and sometimes do analyze those cases. I think it's just a reality that when you're acting as a regulator and you want to regulate the conduct of those within your jurisdiction, bringing an action against a company with and ascribing to that company some disgorgement of ill-gotten gains and some appropriate and tempered penalty sends a message, gets the company on the straight and narrow, enhances their focus on compliance with the law, and allows them to continue in business, but more compliant with the law than ever. But sometimes charging an individual is a little bit of a binary decision. You charge, and that's the end of their career, or you don't charge. And so I think that our remedies and our ability to charge corporations do allow for a little more calibration than they do in the context of charging individuals. So I think that's sort of a very long-winded and twisting and turning answers to your question, but at least it spots some of the issues that are very thorny ones that we grapple with every day.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that not every case against a corporation requires an individual to be charged, and I'm even more happy that this is being recorded. I do want to mention that in the cases, particularly financial crisis cases involving the sales of CDOs and mortgage-backed products, where settlements have been achieved on negligence grounds on, as you said, Section 17 of the 33 Act, the SEC has still gone on to charge individuals who were involved in those sales. I hope
my answer didn't imply we wouldn't. I'm just saying it's not an automatic thing. It's an evaluation of the conduct of an individual.
Right, but if the corporation acting through that individual is guilty of negligence, then it's hard to understand why the individual who did the act is culpable for something more than that negligence.
Well, I'm not. So you're saying you're spotting instances in which the company is charged with negligence,
correct,
but the individual is charged with
fraud.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there are so many such examples.
I can think of one.
And I guess, look, I don't want to get too much into the weeds on this, but I think there are a lot of people who mistake fraud cases for negligence cases. I'll just kind of give you an example. The Martin Act, which Mark can talk about in great detail, I think it's fair to assume does not require scienter.
That's correct.
And that means it doesn't require scienter, but it's certainly triggered when you have scienter. So you engage in an intentional fraud, you violate the Martin Act. You engage in negligent misrepresentation, you violate the Martin Act. And it's just one monochromatic statute. And that means many times serious frauds are charged under the Martin Act, which doesn't require scienter. And just because the statutory provision that at the end of the complaint says, wherefore you violated the Martin Act, doesn't require scienter, doesn't mean that you're not being charged with something that involves scienter. So, I think there are frankly instances where I don't care. I mean, if I have a statute that can be violated through negligent conduct or scienter-based conduct, and I can get the remedy that I think is in the interest of the public, you know, the same penalty, the same disgorgement of ill-gotten gains, the same industry bars and suspensions, I can invoke that statute for fraudulent conduct. So I think one really needs to look, we should really be focusing on the nature of the allegations, which reflect our view, the SEC's view, of what conduct you actually perpetrated as a defendant, and not necessarily which charge, because, the wherefore could include any number of statutory provisions triggered by your misconduct. Maybe that's a little bit of an explanation for maybe something that you're referring to there, but I'm on my hobby horse.
I think that I would go even a little bit further. I'm glad Susan's comforted. It's my view that there is always an individual who is ultimately responsible, either under the requirements of the law or the rules and regulations or the policies and procedures of the institution, or by fact. I think that the issue is an easier one to resolve where the individual is a lone actor or a rogue individual within an institution. More often than not, though, there is a system, a pattern, a practice within which an individual operates. I often find in these investigations that there's this institutional kind of creep where there is an activity which may be a bit outside the norm. It may be well known within the institution. Some of those individuals may then end up going to another bank or institution. And in order to be competitive, they have to find a way to make sure that they are operating in the same sort of sphere. And then you look up, and then the entire industry is engaging in this conduct or behavior. So it's become normative. But from a regulator standpoint, has nonetheless gone on the other side of the line. And so you might look and see a whole institution that is I'll say, tolerating an activity that we would expect senior-level management of the firm to be asking the difficult questions about. And so in those instances, I think that we're always asking who is ultimately responsible for the thing that we have some serious concerns about. That doesn't always mean that the person that you identify is then going to be charged criminally. And certainly, very often, in order to adequately examine those and answer those questions, you need to know and understand whether or not there are written policies and procedures surrounding the thing, what is done when there are red flags relating to that, whether or not the issue is elevated, and whether or not the reasonable steps that you would expect to see along the way are responded to by the group or a person who's ultimately responsible for that. But I think that in any thorough investigation, you're going to have to answer who's responsible for the thing that you believe is wrongful, and then knowing how they got from the activity to your investigation, there I think therein lies the facts by which you can make a decision of whether or not there should be individual culpability.
Thank you. I want to turn the focus just a little bit and actually and talk about particular types of cases. And one in particular is insider trading cases. We've seen a number of those. And my question is kind of why? Is there something unique about, the current environment or something else going on there that is leading into at least a perception that there's kind of more insider trading cases going on? Maybe there's just an ease of kind of targeting those types of cases. I don't know if Susan or George want to talk about that. George.
I don't think this is – I don't have any scientific perspective. I have some personal perceptions of the matter, and I'll share those, but I don't it's anyone's guess. maybe as good as mine. I think insider trading is the incidents. If you look at the various types of violations that we prosecute civilly and criminally, I think insider trading, the disparity between the amount of insider trading and the number of prosecutions and enforcement actions arising from insider trading is probably as great as in any area. I think that if you go back, and look at the last 20, 30 years, there are many, many, many instances of insider trading that have gone undetected and unprosecuted. So to some extent, I think what you're seeing is, better enforcement to some extent. I also think that at least there's reason to suspect that there's a higher incidence. And the reason I suspect there is a somewhat higher incidence is that I think over the last two decades, you have had the development of very sophisticated proprietary trading, often in the form of hedge funds. So there have been hedge funds, obviously, for about 50 years, but there has been an explosive growth in hedge funds. And nothing wrong, obviously, absolutely nothing wrong with being a hedge fund, but hedge fund managers tend to be very sophisticated, very connected to issuers, very connected to sell-side Wall Street. So there are a lot of personal relationships. They are very directed towards earning incremental gains. They are very sophisticated investors. They use leverage, which can mean that information that in my hands is going to make me chump change. it's not even worth my effort to use it. But in the hands of a very skilled investor who's highly leveraged, it could be used very much more effectively. So there's relationships and there's sophistication. Also, we have had great increases in the liquidity of options markets, which is obviously a way to exploit material non-public information, as well as a great decrease in transaction costs for executing trades, both in the options markets and in the equity markets. So there is more opportunity, I think, than ever to take relatively, information such as advance information about whether a company is going to miss its consensus analyst estimates of earnings by, you know, 3 cents per share and turn that information into explosive profit. I just don't think you could as easily turn that information into explosive profit 30 years ago than you could now. And those factors are reasons to suppose there may be actually higher incidence of insider trading and not just higher incidence of detection and enforcement.
Thank you. Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. I want to thank my panel today, Susan, George, and Mark, for sharing your insights and experiences in what I hope everyone found to be a very informative discussion about criminal enforcement of securities laws. Today's discussion will be a valuable addition to the body of knowledge in the Bingham Presents series. An audio of today's program will soon be available in the Virtual Museum and Archive at www.sechistorical.org, and an edited transcript will be added later on. The Bingham website will also have a transcript of today's discussion. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Bingham McCutcheon LLP for their sponsorship and hospitality in making today's program possible. Thanks also to our audiences, both gathered here in Bingham's office in New York and joining us online. I hope everyone has a good evening.